Hi, my name is Chris Brennan, and you're listening to the Astrology Podcast. This episode was recorded on Sunday, July 24th, 2016, starting just after 4 p.m. in Denver, Colorado, and this is the 84th episode of the show. For more information about how to subscribe to the podcast and help support the production of future episodes by becoming a patron, please visit theastrologypodcast.com/subscribe. In this episode, I'm going to be talking with Richard Tarnas about his book Cosmos and Psyche, and the approach to astrology that developed out of it called archetypal astrology. You can find out more information about his work at cosmosandpsyche.com. Before we get started with the interview, just a few quick announcements about the giveaway that we're doing this month. We're giving away two prizes this month, and the first is a one-year subscription to the new online astrology program called Archetypal Explorer. Archetypal Explorer is an online program for personal development based in the practice of archetypal astrology. It uses a powerful method of transit analysis combined with cutting-edge data visualization and cloud computing to display the ebb and flow of archetypal activity over time. It renders both personal and world transit activity and will display transits across any scale of time, from a week to a month to a year to a century. You can use it to navigate backwards and forward in time, in order to inform, orient, and navigate your life in powerful ways. You can find out more information about the program at archetypalexplorer.com. The other prize we're giving away this month is a free copy of the astrology software program called Solarfire. Solarfire is one of the most popular astrological software programs on the market today. It covers the full range of astrological techniques, including natal astrology, synastry, electional, and horary astrology. It also provides tools for various techniques from ancient and classical astrology to Uranian and cosmobiology. Beginners love the array of different interpretations that are available in the program, while professionals enjoy the ability to fully customize the layout of charts. You can find out more information about Solarfire at alabe.com. All you have to do to enter the giveaway is become a patron of the Astrology Podcast through our page on Patreon at the $5 or $10 tier, and then you'll automatically be entered into the drawing, with the winners of this month's giveaway being announced at the end of the month. More details about the monthly raffle and links to find out more information about each of the prizes can be found on the description page for this episode on theastrologypodcast.com. All right, with those announcements out of the way, let's get started with the interview. Hi, Richard. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Chris.
All right. Well, I'm very excited to have you on the show. I've been looking forward to this for a while. And the occasion is that it's actually been 10 years since the publication of your book, Cosmos and Psyche. So I wanted to talk about and sort of give a synopsis of some of the main points that you make in the book, ask a little bit about what the process was of writing it, and also what the outcome has been or what the past decade has been like since its release. So it's been 10 years. When did you release the book again, or do you remember exactly when it came out?
It came out in January of 2006. I had finished all the text writing by January of 05. That's when I put in the last chapter on the current world transits and so forth. But then in September of 05, I was going through the galleys. And at that point, I added a couple of paragraphs that included, like the Katrina, flood that took place a week earlier. But other than that, it was all finished by the beginning of 2005 and then published in January 2006.
Okay. Brilliant. So since it's been 10 years, one of the sort of motivations for this show is just, there's a lot of new and a lot of younger people that have come into the astrological community, which is, you know, my primary audience in the past 10 years that might not be familiar with your work yet. So I thought it would be good to sort of start from the beginning and maybe give them some background on who you are and where you're coming from. So let's start at the beginning, which is just, I guess first we could ask, you were born in 1950, right?
That's right. I was born in Geneva, Switzerland, actually in February 1950. I grew up in the United States and in Michigan, for up until I was 18 and went off to college then.
Okay. And is your birth data public?
Yes. Yeah. It's, for those who are interested, it's February 21st, 1950, 12:30 PM Central European time, Geneva, Switzerland.
Okay. Awesome.
That's a birth certificate.
And so that's an exact time.
Yeah. The Swiss, tend to be pretty precise, it seems.
Sure. They have that reputation. Okay. So, and in terms of your training, earlier in your life, you actually studied classics under the Jesuits, right?
That's right. I of course, educated by nuns in my elementary school, and then went to a Jesuit high school, University of Detroit Jesuit High School, for 4 years, and majored in what they called then, anyway, classical honors, where you study Greek and Latin, and the humanities. So there's a lot of focus on history, on literature, and kind of humanistic culture, along with math and science. But the emphasis is definitely more on the humanities and the ancient languages.
Okay. Well, and that sort of training, you know, learning Greek and Latin and things like that, put you in a unique position in terms of being able to read a lot of the source texts and things in their original language, as well as maybe a background and the ability to do that kind of historical research. Would you say
it helped a lot when you're reading words, even in English? It's helpful to know their Greek and Latin origins. Just like the word archetype, for example, and the rich multivalence of that term arche in Greek, to know that it means original or very early or primordial, but also a power or a province, a domain, but also like the first of something that shapes everything else afterwards, or fundamental, basic, underlying. All those are kind of packed into the word arche, and the word archetype takes on more multivalent meaning when you have that reference back to its origins in Greek. But I think more specifically, I think it was just the encounter with, you know, when you encounter other languages, other cultures, other eras, that can't help but expand your own perspective on the worldview and the linguistic structures and constraints that one lives in when you are just living in the present with a limited language foundation, or matrix, I guess would be a better word. So in that respect, it was expansive to have that constant engagement with other eras, other cultures that had such a big influence on us. And the other big thing in terms of our the work that would eventually become relevant to cosmos and psyche, astrology, and the whole orientation of archetypal astrology, is that having a direct engagement with Plato's view of the archetypes, and then Aristotle's kind of transformation of that concept and vision, that provided me from the high school on with a way of approaching the whole question of concepts and universals, and how do we go from this particular thing to thinking in terms of a larger class of things that particular belongs to. And Plato's understanding of this in terms of these archetypal principles or forms, capital F form, or the ideas, capital I, is that something is beautiful to the exact extent that that painting or that person or that sunset participates in the archetypal idea of the beautiful itself, of the kind of eternal principle of beauty that transcends every local instance of it. And so when Jung recovered the notion of archetype, but psychologically in his understanding of the deep psyche and of the collective unconscious, it was of great interest to me that there was a continuity from Plato to Jung, but there was also a huge difference. And that was actually, even before I knew any astrology, that's what I wanted to write my doctoral dissertation on, was the evolution of the concept of archetypes from Plato to Jung. So there are a number of reasons why that engagement with Greco-Roman culture and the Greek language and Platonic philosophy and Aristotle and so forth was, I think, one of those things that helped orient me from the beginning and helped me when I then went on to college and beyond have a grounding that was very valuable.
And in terms of that, and so a lot of that was already in your background from high school, and then you took some of that background with you already into college, where you started studying and sort of focusing on the Western intellectual and cultural history, right?
That's right. I then went to Harvard and Cambridge, Massachusetts, and that was back in the 1968 to 72 period. That was my 4 years as an undergraduate there. And so the Harvard and Cambridge, like many other university towns during that period, like Berkeley or Madison or Ann Arbor, was a real hotbed of the counterculture. So part of one's education back then was, you know, the psychedelic revolution, the and encounter with Asian mystical traditions like Hindu, Buddhist, Taoist, and so forth, ideas of people like Alan Watts. So that was all in the air. And that kind of allowed a greater, I think, a kind of imaginative and intellectual flexibility for taking seriously a wider range of, let's say, philosophical options, rather than just being held in by a traditional modern Western mindset. So that was helpful. And then, but you're right that I then went on to study like the history of philosophy, the history of depth psychology, starting with William James and Freud and Jung there, and as well as history of music. And I was just very interested in the history of the different cultural and intellectual lineages that seemed rich in their own right, listening to Palestrina or Beethoven or something like that, or reading Shakespeare or Oscar Wilde. But on the other hand, it was giving me a sense of the longer historical and evolutionary process that had brought us forth to this moment, and that was in a certain way living in all of us. So I was very actually passionately drawn to those historical studies.
Sure, in terms of sort of the history of thought and change in thought over time and different sort of identifying different periods of thought or when things would go through a transformation or a change of some sort.
Yeah, that's correct. I was particularly interested in the interior history of our civilization, rather than the military political milestones that might be normally focused on. Although I had a decent head for dates, knowing, you know, say when the French Revolution happened, and of course, which was also intellectually and culturally so significant, but in terms of my primary focus, it was, as you're saying, it was more on that interior of that history of the modern human being that has gone into shaping us, that comes from philosophy, it comes from religion, comes from science, comes from the arts, And all these interact in to shape our worldview, which in turn shapes our sense of who we are in the universe, and what the nature of the universe is. Is it just a disenchanted, you know, mechanistic, neutralized, vast space that we have randomly been find ourselves in, evolved out of random processes, yet somehow have subjectivity, have a capacity for consciousness in this vast unconscious universe? Or is something more mysterious going on? And are there other ways of looking at the universe that perhaps could embed our consciousness in a way that is, it is more coherent and healing rather than alienating and disorienting?
And is that part of what led you then, while you were, I guess you were still in college, to working at the Esalen Institute?
I had actually, I had read about Esalen Institute, which is in Big Sur, California, while I was still at Harvard. In fact, there was an article in the Harvard Crimson newspaper that whose headline was "After Harvard, Esalen?" And I found the article fascinating, and I happened to be one of the few people who actually decided to follow that up after I graduated. But the main reason I came to Esalen was that I wanted to meet and study with Stanislav Grof, who was the world's expert, still is, on psychedelic medicines and LSD psychotherapy, coming out of the psychoanalytic depth psychology tradition, but very much integrated the mystical traditions as well as a clinical psychiatrist. And I'd been so impressed with what I'd read of his work from Abraham Maslow and others that I wanted to meet him. So while the focus on psychedelics had begun there at Harvard, while I was there, actually, Ram Dass, you might know Tim Leary and Richard Alpert, who changed his name later to Ram Dass, had been at Harvard and when they were starting their LSD experiments. And Alan Watts also came there for a while and was kind of a spiritual guide for them in some respects. And all of them, they definitely had a significant impact on me. Not Leary directly so much, although we became friends, but more Ram Dass, and then Alan Watts's work was influential. So in I was kind of prepared to be exploring non-ordinary states of consciousness and what that could tell us about the nature of the mysterious universe we live in, as a result of my college years. But then I came out to California to pursue doctoral studies, and particularly wanted to work with Stan Grof. And as it turned out, Esalen was just a great place. I ended up living there for 10 years and studied with Joseph Campbell and Gregory Bateson, Houston Smith, James Hillman, and quite a few others, because it was this educational center where that honored a wide range of orientations, and it took seriously whether it would be meditation and yoga, or synchronicities and discussion of the Tao or of reincarnation or things like that, or shamans would visit from the Huichol tribes in Mexico and so forth. So as a result, there was a kind of metaphysical, not only tolerance, but passionate curiosity and openness to many different perspectives. And as I learned soon after getting to Esalen, 1974, there was astrology was also part of the vocabulary, part of the worldview there, along with the overall openness to Hindu, Buddhist, Taoist, mysticism or shamanic practices, to the importance of paying attention to synchronicities and things like that.
And you actually went into, so before you got there, I think you say at one point in the book that you just sort of, because of your educational background, had sort of like a predisposition to dismiss astrology and sort of assume that it wasn't something that was intellectually valid, but it was it during this time at Esalen where your views on that changed, or where you were forced to re-examine that?
That's correct. I hadn't really thought a lot about it, but I remember my first encounter with anything to do with astrology was when a professor at Harvard, who had been trained by Jung and taught at the Harvard Divinity School, mentioned to me as a friend, we were seeing each other occasionally and having conversations about Jung and Freud and European culture and so forth. He was from Switzerland. And he at one point started talking about he must have asked my birth date at some point, because he started looking at my and talking a little bit about what signs my different planets were in. And I just thought this was a kind of a trivial pursuit, you know, that I was surprised that someone of such intellectual dignity had just gone in that direction. And I kind of steered the conversation back towards our usual path.
Sure.
And so there was a few years where, I think astrology kind of knocks on your door. And it really is, I think Liz Green once said that astrology more chooses you rather than you choosing it. On the other hand, you can choose to, ignore the invitation. And it wasn't until, I guess, I read more Jung, and then also in the months, year right after leaving Harvard, I read quite a bit of Rudolf Steiner. And in both Jung and Steiner, there was definitely a respectful attitude about astrology, which I, in a general way, started assimilating. But then it was really at Esalen where I first had my chart read, and then the crucial turning point was actually when Stan Groff and I were dealing with a particular research issue that we wanted to that his colleagues and fellow psychiatrists over many years had tried to understand and not been able to make any progress with. And as a result, we were able to make astrology presented itself at that point as a possible avenue of researching why do some people have such different responses than others to the exact same substance, in this case, LSD or mescaline or psilocybin, and even though they're getting the exact same, say, 500 micrograms, and why does the same person at different times also have different responses? And there, none of the traditional psychological tests that were employed by the clinics back in Maryland and in Prague, where Stan had worked, had any none of those tests had any validity. They just seemed completely irrelevant to what kinds of experiences people actually were having. There wasn't any predictive power. And at that point, Stan and I both had sufficient, at least openness to the possibility that astrology might be of value in looking at it. Someone, an astrologer named Arne Trutovic, was visiting Esalen, actually was in a month-long seminar that Stan was offering on Buddhism. And he shared with Stan and me his conviction that people's experiences were very much reflective of the personal transits that they were going through. And he taught us how to calculate birth charts. This is back in 75, 76, when one had to do all this by hand and with, you know, reference books, et cetera, like tables of houses and latitudes and longitudes. But it was, you know, relatively simple math, as you know, and we were able to calculate our transits and our birth charts, and we had very good records for our sessions, and we were just astonished by the correlations between the kinds of experiences that we and other people had in these non-ordinary states of consciousness that were so powerful, so kind of archetypally saturated, a kind of mythic intensity. You couldn't miss their qualities. And lo and behold, it really fit the planetary principles that were being highlighted by the planet, by the planetary transits to the natal chart. And this was so consistent and so accurate. It had such a kind of nuanced quality of correlation that we had to reassess our initial skepticism that astrology, I think, was the last of the new paradigm or ancient esoteric methods that we took seriously. But it turned out to be the most valuable one of all, not only in shining a light on our particular research interests at this point, which was understanding powerful transformational experiences, which people coming to Esalen seem to specialize in having, with or without psychedelics. But it was also valuable for understanding artists. And we looked at the birth chart of a Michelangelo or of a Beethoven or of a Jane Austen, or you looked at the personal transits of Galileo when he turned his telescope to the heavens. It just kind of blew our minds, basically. And so it was from that point on, and this is early 1976. I remember the turning point, really. It was March, March 1976. From that point on, I recognized that astrology was the most interesting thing to me of anything I'd studied in my life, and I was interested in a lot of things. But and one of the reasons for that interest was that it shone a light on every other subject that I was interested in, whether it was history or psychology or art and literature, even the fine points of philosophical issues like how do we know things, epistemology, not to mention the whole issue around is the cosmos meaningful, purposeful, and souled, or is it a mechanistic, random, process of matter and energy with no deeper, purposes or humanly meaningful categories at work in it? Those, every one of those, areas of vital study to me, of vital interest, was illuminated, by astrology in the most extraordinary way. So it's really became a lifelong passion. I guess now it's 40 years ago now that awakening happened.
Right. So your initial access point is just this discovery that people in altered states of consciousness that you could actually predict or more reliably anticipate through their transits, through their astrological transits, what kind of experience they're going to have than any other sort of diagnostic tool that you had available at the time. But then once you made that realization, then suddenly you realized how applicable it was to all of these other fields of study that you already had a deep interest in.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay, great. So yeah. And so that was exactly 40 years ago. So we're sort of at the anniversary, you know, of that as well this year, which is kind of interesting. So that year, I think 76, you got your PhD, right?
That's correct.
Okay. And then you said that it took you, your first book, or your I think it was your first book, technically, was Passion of the Western, or Passion of the Western Mind, which you said took you 10 years to write. So you must have started writing it just a few years afterwards, around 1980.
That's right. I began in, I guess, in late 78 with some writing that eventually went into what became Cosmos and Psyche and the essay Prometheus, the Awakener. I wrote an early version of that in late 78, early 79. This is right as I'm in my Saturn return. I was 28, almost 29, just as that was happening.
Nice.
That's really when I connected deeply with the Charles Harvey and the British Astrological Association, John Addy. Rob Hand and I had been friends for two or three years at that point. I invited him to Esalen, along with other astrologers, to present Jim Lewis, Zip Dobbins, and others. But it was really from when I was 29 that I started writing more astrologically, but also thinking about the philosophical dimensions of what I was studying. And at a certain point in 1980, I realized that I really needed to write actually as a few chapters that I thought were going to be at the beginning of Cosmos and Psyche. I wanted to write an introduction for the general reader that would both explain the whole understanding of archetypes and how it evolved from the ancient Greeks, or even from the mythic, if we think of gods and goddesses as being the archaic primordial way in which the archetypes were experienced in the ancient imagination. It's as very powerful beings that are personified, and that one can still experience them this way in special states of consciousness, usually. And then to show that whole evolution from the mythic to the Platonic and the Aristotelian understanding of the archetypes and universal forms, and then how that evolved all the way up to the modern worldview, and then depth psychology coming partly out of Romanticism and its deep interest in the profound inner psyche, was able to reconnect to a mythic and archetypal domain with that informs the human psyche in a very powerful and general, seemingly universal way. So I wanted people to have a sense for, here's this very rich concept of archetypes that goes all the way back and seems to be an explanatory principle for understanding the basic meanings of the planets. Because when you read any conventional astrological textbook about what a Mars-Venus conjunction represents, or a Saturn-Mercury opposition, you can see at work that every single specific detail that is described as characteristic of that Saturn-Mercury opposition in a natal chart or in a transit or a Venus-Mars conjunction, you can see how each of them has been, the descriptions are based on understandings of universal principles that are essentially archetypes. They simultaneously seem to act as inner psychological drives and impulses, and they express themselves in images, but they also can be experienced as gods and goddesses. They also can be philosophically understood as transcending principles along the lines of Plato's understanding of the archetypes. They could be seen as Freudian instincts. This is partly under the influence of James Hillman, who became a major mentor and friend during these years in my late 20s, early 30s. And his wonderful book, called Revisioning Psychology, really the master work of and manifesto of archetypal psychology. And his work really gave me an inspiration for being able to write astrology and astrological matters in a way that drew on everything else I learned in terms of cultural history and literature and philosophy and depth psychology. But to get back to your question, I felt that before I try to serve as a bridge for the educated, skeptical public, skeptical of even the remotest possibility that astrology was anything more than an idle game you might play as you read the Sunday horoscope column, I felt that I needed to introduce the reader to a bigger historical context, both in terms of understanding the nature of the meanings, the archetypes, but also in terms of understanding how our worldview has shifted, so that what in an earlier era, such as in ancient Greece or Egypt or Mesopotamia, Rome, even in the medieval Christian period in Europe, there was a much greater plausibility to the astrological cosmos. The entire universe was just seen as being structured and imbued with intrinsic meanings that held great significance for the human being, and that in some sense seemed to be focused on the Earth, which in a pre-Copernican universe was much more plausible. As soon as you had the Copernican revolution, this radically changed the game, changed the cosmic structure, and opened up the possibility of the mechanistic universe. So because I had studied the Copernican revolution in some depth at Harvard, I'd taken one of the most influential courses that I ever took was the one that Thomas Kuhn, who wrote The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, and another book called The Copernican Revolution, which for him is the paradigm of all paradigms, or the paradigm revolution of all paradigm revolution. I took the course that he had helped shape there when he was at Harvard, and I took it under the great astronomy professor, Owen Gingerich. And so I wanted to bring in that understanding as well as to how the Copernican revolution had played a role in this. And by the time I finished setting out this historical background, bringing us really right up to date to the postmodern period, when many things, including the modern assumptions about the nature of reality, were now coming into question. By the time I finished this, I realized this was too much to be the opening three or four chapters of my book on astrology, Cosmos and Psyche. I realized it really should probably be published as a book in itself. I named it Passion of the Western Mind. And then the Random House found out about the two books through a series of connections. Someone who was enthusiastic about my works, letting somebody else know, who was a literary agent, who let the head of Ballantine know about it. And then they read it. They read Passion of the Western Mind, as well as the outline of Cosmos and Psyche. And they said, let's do it. Let's publish it. Thought it was going to do very well. Interestingly, they thought Cosmos and Psyche would be the blockbuster, and that the Passion of the Western Mind would be a way to get there, to establish credibility. What they didn't expect was, and nor did I, was that Passion of the Western Mind would catch on quite quickly, and it became, you know, a text that's used in many universities, both here in the States and in abroad. I really wrote it for the general reader, but it also got picked up by an academic context, which was great. And it allowed me to, that's actually when I became a professor and started teaching, which delayed my completion of Cosmos and Psyche by another 10 or 15 years. But it was worth it because I was able to teach the material in Cosmos and Psyche at my school, California Institute of Integral Studies in San Francisco, which to my surprise, not only the students, but my fellow faculty and the administration were eager for me to teach not only the Passion of the Western Mind, History of Philosophy kind of courses, but also courses that were about my research with Stan Grof that involved the planetary correlations with psychological states, and were very much indebted to that ethos of metaphysical expansiveness that is part of our school's origins, that allowed us to teach that material for now over 20 years. And that very much went into the how I ended up finishing Cosmos and Psyche.
Okay. And so backing up a little bit, you wanted from the very start, from the late 1970s, you already started writing basically a book on astrology where you wanted to demonstrate, or you had noticed that major outer planet alignments coincided with or correlated with major shifts in Western thought and Western intellectual traditions. But then in order to demonstrate that premise, that and to show that, you know, shifts in Western thought coincided with major astrological alignments, you first had to answer the question of, you know, what are some of the major shifts in history? And so that's where Passion of the Western Mind comes from, essentially.
Yeah, actually, I wanted to trace the background to the concepts that astrology depends on, uses, but I also wanted to trace the background to our current cultural rejection of astrology as being, you know, as I like to say, it's the gold standard of superstition in our culture. It's what one goes to, one points to, if you want to say something is superstitious, is worthy of intellectual scorn at best, and just being ignored, if at all possible. That attitude about astrology comes out of an extraordinary history, and it's not a simply rational attitude that is based on a clear understanding of the evidence. There are good reasons for that rejection. I think in some ways astrology had to be negated by the modern mind and modern self at a certain point for modernity to and the modern self to emerge with sufficient autonomy that it could then re-engage the cosmos, an ensouled cosmos, in a new way, in a more co-creative, participatory way. But in order to get to that point, there had to be a kind of a loss, a negation, a what was felt at first as a liberation from the old astrological ensouled cosmos, but then eventually was experienced as a widely as a kind of state of alienation and disorientation in a cosmic void, which to a certain extent characterizes the late modern and postmodern existentialist crisis. So I really wanted to have readers understand the context in which the astrological evidence now can be looked at with new eyes and with greater sophistication.
Sure. And so this was like going to be initially, as you said, just the first few chapters, almost like a preface to your main work. But then it's released in 1991 and it becomes wildly successful. And it's not just generally successful, but also becomes assigned reading in a bunch of university courses. And you become sort of, to some extent, almost like a celebrated intellectual figure, maybe not on the level of like, you know, Thomas Kuhn or somebody like that. But
I wouldn't say it became, you know, it wasn't like wildly popular. I think it was, and it did way better than a book like that, you know, of intellectual history can ever assume that we'll do. But I think it sold at this point about 250,000 copies, which is good for a book that really sought to honor the intelligence of the reader and his or her interest in the profundity and complexity of our intellectual and spiritual and cultural history. But it what was surprising to me was that it was picked up by, I stopped counting after it reached about 100 universities that, you know, they were using it at Harvard or UC Berkeley or and in seminaries and so forth. That was a surprise.
Sure. Yeah. Especially because even though you don't really talk about astrology in the book, you had this sort of not ulterior motive, but it was just sort of the preface to something else that you were building up to that wasn't necessarily clear in that book.
Right. It turned out to be a Trojan horse in that respect.
Sure. Into sort of the intellectual, because it established your sort of credibility with, maybe intelligentsia isn't the right word, but in academia, it established your credibility. And then from that, as you said, then you sort of started your career teaching, and you started teaching at CIAS in California and developed the program there. And what's the name of the program again?
It's called the Philosophy, Cosmology, and Consciousness Program. It's part of the philosophy and religion larger department, but our philosophy, cosmology, and consciousness program, PCC for short, we founded it in 1994, and Stan Groff, Brian Swim, Charlene Spretnak, David Ulansey, and myself, Robert McDermott, we were the kind of the original co-founders, and then Sean Kelly came into the faculty, now Elizabeth Allison as well. But in addition, we have I'm not sure how many hundreds of graduates have come through it for the master's and PhD program over these years, but some of the people that actually have played a role now in archetypal cosmology came through the program. Kieran LeGrice, for example, and Rod O'Neill, Matt Siegel, Becca Tarnas, and others. So we're Erica Jones Jessica Garfield Cabrera, Chad Harris, Matthew Stelzner, Delia Chargal. These are just wonderful. They've become wonderful teachers, scholars, therapists, professors, and so forth that have come through the program.
So it's in that context, while you're involved in that program and you're teaching and you're sort of writing this book all along that is going to be this huge tome that you've been working on since the late 1970s. But you're also able to, there's sort of developing a bit of a community around it, or you're able to share portions of it with some of your students and get feedback at that time, right?
That's correct. That was extremely useful.
All right. So eventually the you've gone through the whole writing process, and the book is released in 2006. And so the external premise of the book was essentially, I guess the way I would state it from an outsider's perspective is what if a prominent contemporary Western intellectual wrote a book in which he tried to make the case for astrology and explain what it is in a modern context while demonstrating how it works? And, you know, one of the things I think a lot of people in the astrological community don't necessarily realize is that it wasn't necessarily written for the astrological community, but instead it was written essentially in order to convince intellectuals and academics that there's something to astrology. Do you feel like that's an accurate synopsis?
That's right. I mean, I thought, you know, some astrologers would be interested in it, that it wasn't going to come as a revelation to them that astrology was valuable or that it worked. But I thought, well, there may be correlations and there may be formulations in the book that they might find helpful. But you're correct that it was more, I was trying to write for, in a way, for the future and for the future of astrology, being accepted, re-embraced into the heart of our cultural life, because it certainly deserves to be. It's way more, intellectually sophisticated and psychologically, sophisticated than what, certainly than the way it's viewed, but by the mainstream, but it's actually, at a higher level of sophistication than much contemporary psychology. For example, Stan Grof, who knows psychology inside and out as a long-term psychiatrist, and psychoanalyst and therapist, he views, astrology as the Rosetta Stone of the human psyche, and Jung too often made comments along that line, and I think they're completely correct.
Sure. So you basically wanted to present that insight that you had suddenly and sort of unexpectedly had back in the mid 1970s, that there's actually something to astrology, and not only that is there something to it, but it sort of becomes the key or becomes this interesting lens through which you can look at and analyze and get a different perspective on all of these other fields. And then you yourself were in a very unique and good position to try to make that argument to the academic community or to the intellectual community, because, as you said earlier, the almost sort of subversive nature of Cosmos and Psyche as a follow-up to The Passion of the Western Mind, which went over very well in 1991, but that otherwise you wrote the book knowing that it was kind of like a scandalous thing for a university professor to come out with a book that's supportive of astrology, because it's, as you said, viewed as sort of the gold standard of superstition.
Yeah. By contrast, it turns out to be a kind of philosopher's stone. I mean, it just is so valuable in whatever direction you turn it on, whether it's political understanding our current political moment in the United States or globally, or if you're wanting to look at the nature of Jennifer Lawrence's particular power as an actress in our time, and looking at her birth chart and how connects with world transits and so forth. In all these ways, astrology just provides a lens and a frame of reference that I don't think can be matched in any place else in the academic world, which would just sound absurd to any good academic who did not have a good grasp of astrology, who had not been initiated into it. But so it goes.
Sure. And basically, I mean, that's what the book ended up being, was sort of like a brilliant book on modern astrology, where if anybody was ever going to be successful in attempting to make the case for astrology in a sort of as an intellectually, as a subject that was deserving of intellectual interest, or that one should not dismiss out of hand, then this was essentially it. And in terms of some of the themes in the book, you start out with this great analogy that it was always one of my favorite parts of the book, where, although you don't mention astrology until I think page 61, so pretty far into the book, you end up drawing this very long, extended analogy between the Copernican Revolution as an analogy for astrology today in some sense, right?
Yeah, I left it to the reader to figure out that's what I was doing. It wasn't the only thing I was doing with that analysis of the Copernican Revolution, because I also believe the Copernican Revolution made possible the modern self, and it summarized everything that we received from the ancient Greeks and the medieval developments, and then it also led to so many, almost everything we can think about in modernity including the postmodern period, is set in motion by the Copernican Revolution. So I wanted to emphasize that pivotal role that it played, but in doing so, it provides such a perfect parallel to the astrologer today who makes a discovery that would be just, you know, rejected out of hand by all the major intellectual and cultural authorities of that era. So there is that real parallel there.
Sure. Just in terms of, you know, having a new, I think you wrote basically having a new, imagine you have a new theory that conflicts not only with just, you know, common sense, but also with, you know, religious authorities, like passages from the Bible when interpreted literally, or even with many of the most cogent and long established principles in physics and cosmology. And you're writing about basically the Copernican theory and the theory that the sun is the center of the solar system, that the earth revolves around the sun, the heliocentric theory, which was his sort of argument, and making a similar sort of analogy in terms of today, just in terms of the way that astrology in an intellectual sense, if you just come to it as a general sort of person with a relatively decent education or background, doesn't on the face of it seem like it makes any sense, or like that would be a possible or plausible thing from sort of like a cosmological perspective, and therefore it is sort of rejected out of hand, and yet there might be something to it.
Yes, and it helps to know that in order for the Copernican Revolution to succeed, it scientists and philosophers had to rethink their basic assumptions about not just the movements of the planets, but and the fact that the Earth might be moving. They had to rethink the very basics of physics. Everything from the Aristotelian point of view had things fell because they were falling to the center of the Earth, because the Earth was a stable center of the universe, and heavy things had a natural inclination to fall towards that center. And we also had to come up with explanations for why is it, if the Earth is moving, that buildings aren't falling over, or that we don't lose our balance as the Earth is rotating and revolving in different directions at once. It just, how could that be possible? And in order to make the Copernican Revolution and the heliocentric theory even plausible, the very basics of physics had to be changed. And that involved a lot of, you know, that was the whole paradigm shift that Thomas Kuhn used as a kind of model for all paradigm shifts, that it's not just a matter of new data coming in. It makes, you need an entirely different theoretical gestalt that allows you to see new data that you wouldn't even have been visible before, and it allows you to reconceive everything that you had been looking at in a different way, much as you can flip back and forth between a black vase as being two faces in white faces in profile, and you can go back and forth between those two gestalt images. It's the exact same drawing, but the different perception gives us an entirely different result. It's a different interpretation, and it allows us to see the data in totally different ways. So that was another reason why I wanted to bring in the Copernican Revolution, is that for astrology just can't be added to the conventional modern materialistic worldview. Astrology really has to we have to rethink the nature of causality. We have to rethink the nature of the structure of the universe. We have to rethink the relationship of the inner human psyche to the external material world, which is in the modern worldview so sharply divided so that thoughts and ideas and emotions are just inside our heads, while the world outside is just matter and energy. But this is not at all the way, let's say, indigenous Native Americans or Aboriginal Australians looked at the universe. Completely different. The wind, the plants, the birds, the sun and moon, they were also, they had interiors. They were capable of communicating meanings. It wasn't just, meaning wasn't just a human construct. It was, meanings pervaded all of reality. And that requires a total paradigm shift for the modern self, which I think really, in order to go through that paradigm shift, the modern self has to let go of its old identity, its old assumptions, and go through a kind of ego death, which in fact our era seems to be precipitating in various ways.
Sure. So the Copernican revolution sort of necessitated a paradigm shift, and in some ways it couldn't take place, or it couldn't be validated within the context of the old model. It required a complete rethinking of everything. So in that, in light of that, that's part of what you try to outline in this book, which is what would the cosmos have to be like in order for something like astrology to be valid in some sense? How, in the specific way that you define it. So one of the things that you identify as a source of an issue and a point of conflict that the astrological premise directly comes into conflict with is the idea of what you call the disenchanted worldview as both a source of problems with the world, but also something that astrology seems to sort of contradict in some sense, right?
That's correct. The disenchanted worldview emerges out of the scientific revolution and the Reformation, each playing a major role in that process. But it ends up in a world in which only the human being is seen as having conscious intelligence and capacity for moral and aesthetic evaluation. And because of that, the rest of the world can be seen as just an object. We're subjects, but the world is seen as an object, like ancient growth forests or animals or planets and so forth. And they're therefore either our kind of mechanistic explanation, or they're there to be used as resources. Animals are harvested. Old growth forests are nothing but lumber in potential, and so forth. And that objectification of the world and exploitation of the natural environment instead of a kind of reverence for it as an ensouled community of beings that we are members of has gone a long ways towards creating the global ecological catastrophe that we're all facing today. And it also has gone a long ways towards creating that sense of lonely isolation that is the hallmark of the modern existentialist predicament of being, you know, a lonely speck of meaning-seeking dust in a vast, unconscious, purposeless, meaningless cosmos. That whole litany of decentered isolation that is characteristic of the kind of modern heroic sense of being the only island of rational consciousness around has gone a long ways towards shaping the spiritual crisis of our time as well.
Sure. So part of the solution that you sort of introduced as a contrast was drawing on some ancient thought like Plato, the idea of the human psyche actually being embedded in a larger sort of world psyche or world soul, depending on how you want to frame it. and this being part of the both the explanatory rationale for astrology as well as a solution to the sort of disenchanted worldview. So taking this ancient idea of the cosmos as somehow ensouled, I guess, as part of the basic premise or philosophical premise of the book.
Yes, the Platonic, and I would say the whole Platonic tradition, including Plotinus, the great Neoplatonist, who develops these thoughts even further in terms of the anima mundi, the world soul. But I also attempt to emphasize both in the course of Cosmos and Psyche, certainly by the end, as well as in my classes, the importance of the shift that is possible in our time through having gone through the long modern development and the modern differentiation of an autonomous human consciousness. It allows certain possibilities that were not available to the ancients in terms of how we relate to this ensouled cosmos and how we, for example, can respond to tracking our personal transits or looking at our natal chart and regarding it. We can regard it in a different way than would have been characteristic of earlier eras, though there were a whole range of ways, as you especially know, Chris, of interpretations and ways of responding in among the ancients, the Hellenistic, the Roman, the medieval mindset was not just a kind of monolith in how it regarded astrology, but there were certain tendencies widely shared that modernity, having gone through the whole process of differentiation that we've been describing, permits a new kind of way of co-creatively responding to the powerful forces that we associate with the heavens, with the planet, not in a mechanistic causal way, but as cosmic forces that also live within the human psyche and the collective psyche of humanity.
Yeah, and I think that makes a lot of sense. And your general point about, you know, the downfall of astrology and its loss of sort of scientific and intellectual credibility, while after the scientific revolution and in the modern period, sort of allowing you know, the modern mindset to rebuild itself in a different way, and then to reinvent astrology in a way that allows for greater self-autonomy and more empowerment. That's certainly, you know, something that maybe wouldn't have happened quite as much or wouldn't have happened in the same way if astrology hadn't lost its credibility first. You wouldn't have had this ability for it to sort of completely reinvent itself in the 20th century along more modern, almost sort of humanistic lines.
That's correct. And I think we also have our a better grasp of the rich multivalence of symbols, the nature of symbols and of metaphors that is it gives us a more intellectually and psychologically flexible way of understanding the meanings of the astrological meanings. That's something that could become more clear if we unpacked one particular principle, for example. But the basic point is just that we've had a couple hundred years now, particularly the last 100 years, of delving deeply into the very nature of symbolism and the various ways in which archetypes can be formulated and experienced, and the ways in which metaphor informs our thinking, our vocabulary, our language, our fantasy, and so forth. All of these give us tools for approaching the knowledge that Saturn is opposing my moon, or Uranus is squaring my Jupiter. It gives me tools to approach the range of potentialities that transit signifies that were not available to somebody who was looking at Saturn opposite the moon in 20 BCE in Rome.
Sure, because you're explicitly approaching it from the point of finding a way for that to be empowering in some sense.
Empowering also, what is it? I don't want it to seem as just a matter of human beings appropriating it to become more powerful themselves. There's sure. also a kind of respect and reverence for the cosmos's own intentions that we perhaps can more intelligently participate in by being aware of them, and also by bringing greater consciousness to the enactment of the astrological influences that are coming through us. We may be able to be more skillful in how we express those energies, rather than the often destructive way we can express them if they're entirely unconscious and kind of possessing us like a complex.
Sure, right. And just the idea of co-creation, I think, is a term that's often used in that regard.
That's right, yeah.
So one of the most controversial points about astrology that you said when presenting it to the public was the point that it posits an intrinsically meaning permeated cosmos. So the idea that the cosmos is not random and meaningless, but that there's this sort of subtle ordering of things that's happening. And there's something from a modern, especially like scientific or scientism perspective that is deeply, maybe offensive isn't the right word, but it's just diametrically opposed to the modern conceptualization of the world as essentially random and meaningless.
Correct. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a real challenge for the dualistic modern mindset, which basically stops the presence of meaning inside the human cranium. Anything out there that we might be seeing as bearing meaning has to be seen as being put there by human consciousness. We're imbuing it. We're projecting it. But the idea that the cosmos could be bearing it in some intrinsic way is just anathema to the disenchanted mainstream modern worldview.
Right. And you then go on to sort of demonstrate that, or a large part of the book is focused essentially on a demonstration of that by saying, you know, look at all these planetary cycles that coincide with either people's biographies or major world events, or maybe major shifts in intellectual trends in concert with different planetary transits and cycles. And the implication that this implies that there's more of an orderliness, or there's more of an underlying sense of sort of meaningfulness or purpose underlying events than there should be otherwise, according to our sort of contemporary understanding of the nature of the cosmos.
That's correct. I mean, there is basically the kinds of correlations that we observe shouldn't be happening if we truly lived in a mechanistic cosmos. That tendency that historians will note when a particular era will just have a kind of wave of revolutions that are happening in different parts of the globe that are not in touch with each other in the, let's say, 17th century. It's a mystery, or even where they are in touch with each other, but somehow something catches fire in 1789, 1790s and sweeps through Europe and much France and much of Europe, but also is there happening at the same time with the mutiny on the Bounty in Tahiti and the revolution of the slaves in Haiti. All these synchronistic waves of what a Jungian would call archetypal phenomena taking place in so many fields, in so many areas of the world simultaneously, they shouldn't be happening. And nor should they be happening with the same planetary alignments happening in which similar phenomena took place at other times when those same planets were in alignment. I mean, just take our own time right now, which is going through the Uranus square Pluto. Why is it that so many people, completely non-astrological people, are noting that the cultural and political quality of our time, the zeitgeist, has so many resemblances to the 1960s, to the 1930s, in many other ways, the potential for mass populist eruptions of discontent and defiance that are led by demagogic individuals, but also the very characteristic qualities that we see in the 60s of the empowerment of women, of youth, environmentalism, of civil rights issues and minorities and so forth, sexual revolution kinds of things. Why such parallels? And also going right back to the French Revolutionary epoch, when all those characteristics that I just mentioned were also characteristic of that period that also had Uranus opposite Pluto. The square in the 1930s, the opposition and the conjunction in the 1960s, now the square again in our time. There's a coherence of patterning here, of archetypal patterning, that's expressing itself both synchronically, many things happening of the same quality in many fields across the world at the same time, and then also diachronically, namely that through time at other periods, such as the 60s or the 30s or the 1790s and other epochs that I studied, analyzed carefully in Cosmos and Psyche that had the same Uranus-Pluto quadrature alignments, show the same motifs, all of which are reflective of everything that contemporary astrologers agree are connected to the meanings of Uranus and Pluto in interaction. That just should not be happening. And it's the correlations are just dazzling. I mean, they shatter the limited mindset. There's no way that one can readily assimilate the nuance, the massiveness, the complexity of the correlations by adding it to a kind of conventional Newtonian, Cartesian, Einsteinian universe. We have to bring in more than that. We have to draw on the wisdom traditions that come from other eras and other cultures in order to begin to grasp the mystery that we're witnessing here.
Sure, and you spend a large part of the majority of the book demonstrating this through the study of larger historical epochs and showing cultural shifts through planetary cycles or shifts that occurred together in synchronicity with cultural cycles, like looking at the Uranus-Pluto cycle that you mentioned, or looking at the Saturn-Pluto cycle, and especially the conjunctions and the oppositions. And that's sort of the practical demonstration of the book, which takes up the majority of it. But in the beginning, you also tried to set down a philosophical foundation for, you know, you're going to demonstrate that this is happening. So then the next question is, why is this happening, or how is this happening? And one of the things that you do is sort of adapt Carl Jung's theory of synchronicity as an explanatory mechanism or principle for astrology, although you sort of expand it so that it's not restricted to the occasional or the spontaneous events that he was focused on or usually tended to define it as. but instead something that can be a regularly occurring phenomenon, right?
That's correct. I mean, he himself did say that astrology could, in fact, be seen as a kind of systematic global form of or cosmic form of synchronicity happening on that vast scale. But he, in his essay on synchronicity and the paper that he gave at Aranos, the focus was much more on other kinds of synchronicities that were more kind of one-off striking breakthroughs of unexpected meaning, where the inner world and the outer world exactly matched, like the golden scarab beetle flying in the window at the same of the therapist and patient at the same time that the patient is describing this very significant dream in which he'd been given a golden scarab in the dream context itself, and that had this very powerful effect on her as a patient in contemplating that why did that insect want to get into this window at that moment, you know, and just the idea that, as Plotinus says, it seems that everything breathes together. So anyway, Jung was particularly focused on that type of synchronicity. But the fact is, he was paying attention to synchronicities all the time. They were very ongoing in his life. He was very attentive to them the way a shaman or a Tao Te Ching, a kind of Tao Te Ching sage would be attentive to synchronistic phenomena. And he was also deeply interested in astrology and was, in fact, at the time I was born in February 1950, he actually wrote a letter on the day I was born in Switzerland to a scientist just saying how obsessed he was at that point studying astrology and synchronicity, trying to wrap his mind around it and to understand it better. And he's trying to apply statistics at that point to it. And that's why he was contacting the scientist. But
wow, that's a pretty impressive sort of synchronicity of itself. And then you're actually born with the Gemini rising and the ruler of the ascendant in the ninth house, which is traditionally, and I think in modern times, still associated with astrology.
Yes, and one could also bring up my having Uranus rising too. So indeed, there are some pretty interesting, I think everybody has birth synchronicities. They seem to converge around births and deaths and periods of, you know, crises and deep transformations, deep threshold periods. That seems to be when synchronicities tend to be constellated with unusual frequency and intensity.
Sure. And the general point, though, is that in terms of synchronicity and its relevance for astrology was just that he was interested in investigating, you know, things that coincide in time that share an equivalency of meaning, but don't necessarily have a causal direct causal connection between the two, but instead they're just happening at the same moment in time and sharing a similar sort of symbolism. And this is where that becomes a useful sort of explanatory principle for astrology, because as you pointed out in the book, the dominant view in the 20th century is that the planets do not necessarily cause events to happen, or the events that they correlate with, either in an individual's life or in world events, it doesn't necessarily cause them to happen, but instead they're just coinciding with time and sharing an equivalency of meaning. And a large part of your book is both demonstrating that is regularly and consistently true, but also trying to explain a broader philosophical framework for how that's even possible.
Yes, I think causality still does play a role, in the sense that I think there is something like archetypal causation, which, in other words, the planet seen as that, you know, body out there of Mars or the moon, Pluto, etc. There, that physical body, I don't think is causing in a typical mechanistic linear form whatever phenomenon I'm going through. That rocky body isn't causing me to be angry or bold or emotional or whatever. Rather, but I think at a certain level, the archetype, which is can be seen as in a way both inside and outside, it's part of the anima mundi. It's part of the what you know Plotinus would think of as the anima mundi or world soul. That does seem to have some causal capacity, but it's more in the sense of formal causation. That is, it's shaping the experience. It's what's giving the pattern, the meaning, the form to the experience. And then there's also an element of final causation, which was Aristotle's term, as was formal causality. Final causation is where something has a purpose. It's being it is unfolding towards realizing a purpose that, from the point of view of Jung, synchronicities were always moving us towards greater wholeness. It was overcoming the barrier between unconscious and conscious and moving the psyche towards a state of greater wholeness and therefore healing and also contact with the numinous. And in that sense, synchronicities were serving a purpose, and that would be considered an example of final causation. But the fact that when two people who have, let's say, a Mars-Venus conjunction between them, Mars is in her chart is conjoined Venus in the other person's chart, and they engage in a passionate kiss, just as, let's say, the Sun or Mars is crossing that Mars-Venus conjunction in their synastry. Well, that would be an example of of formal causation in the sense that Venus, with its impulse towards romantic experience and tender expression and sensuous experience, is combining with the Mars physicality and the ardor and the more erotically young impulse. They're combining together to create what goes into a kiss. And that's an example of the archetypal forms are shaping, are configuring the experience. And that would be a kind of causation, but I don't think it's the planets causing so much as the archetypes or the gods. They're the ones that are more in a, can be seen as having some kind of causal efficacy.
Okay. So, and that's something that you've actually been exploring, I think, in the last two issues of the Archite Journal, which is, there's a few issues of which we'll talk about in a minute, but you've been exploring this issue of what are the astrological, what are the planetary archetypes and how are they working? And if there is some form of causality, how do you define that or what is the nature of it, right?
That's correct. Yeah. What you're referring to are some notes on archetypal dynamics and complex causality that I wrote just prior to the writing Cosmos and Psyche, when I gave myself full time starting in 2002 to the writing of Cosmos and Psyche from 2002 to 2004. And just before I started that full time composition, I took the time out to think through the philosophical nuances of what are we witnessing when we study astrological correlations? What does it mean to say that a Mars-Venus conjunction comes through in a particular way? And so I kind of unpacked it from various perspectives, and that's been published in two issues of Archive Journal, as you mentioned.
Okay. All right. So transitioning on then into the sort of next section as we start to wrap this up in the next 30 minutes or so, I wanted to talk about this new sort of approach or this new school of astrology that's been emerging in the past 10 years since the release of Cosmos and Psyche that you're referring to as archetypal astrology. And this seems to be essentially the approach that you developed after studying the astrological tradition and then refining it, that includes the techniques and the conceptualizations that seem to make the most sense to you, or seem to be the most reliable or plausible, in which you set the sort of foundation for in Cosmos and Psyche, right?
That's correct, yeah.
Okay, so and the way it comes off is essentially that it's a more well-articulated and theoretically consistent approach to modern astrology, which also has an integrated technical and philosophical structure, essentially, right?
Yes, or you know, it's always a work in progress, but that we do attempt to be, philosophically reflective about the concepts and the assumptions and the history of what has shaped our modus operandi. Yeah.
Okay. And also, it seems like it was partially characterized as a sort of attempt to create a standardized approach that could be used in an academic context. And I know one of your students, Kieran LeGrice, said that he said, quote unquote, I think it was in one of the Archite journals, he said it's the emergence of a new academic field centered on the archetypal approach to astrology. And that's sort of how he defined archetypal astrology.
I think he was. I can't remember the exact place where that quote happened, but my guess is that he was talking about archetypal cosmology, which is the more general discipline within which archetypal astrology is the core. The difference between that is between those two is that archetypal astrology is particularly focused on the tracking of correlations as we see them in natal charts and in personal transits and in world transits and chart comparisons and relationships and progressions and so forth. So that would be the focus of archetypal astrology with a special emphasis on the significance of the planetary archetypes and the aspects between the planets. But the but archetypal cosmology is the larger field of interest and several disciplines that, in a sense, archetypal astrology points towards. Like we want to understand what kind of a cosmos do we live in which these planetary correlations could exist, because it's a very different universe than what we're taught in the mainstream scientific worldview. There's also the interest in integrating the insights of depth psychology, Jung, Freud, Hillman, Groff, transpersonal psychology, feminist psychology, archetypal psychology that comes from Hillman and Jung, and so forth. So there's also a great deal of interest in cultural history and biography. So that larger range of, you could say, scholarly disciplines that provide a context within which archetypal astrology is the core, and archetypal astrology shines a light on all those, but all those also shine a light on astrology. We think, for example, astrology and psychology both have about equal amount to learn from each other and can be enriched and illuminated and emancipated by each other. It's not a one-way influence or effect.
Sure. And within this context, how are you defining the use of the term archetype or archetypal, either within the context of archetypal cosmology or especially in particular within the case of archetypal astrology?
Well, it's the term that simultaneously harkens back to the original Platonic understanding. I mentioned the idea of the archetype of beauty, the capital B, not just any this thing or that person or that experience as being beautiful, but the very principle of the beautiful with a capital T that endures when the flower dies. But then reemerges in the butterfly or the sound of music that somebody's listening to. That that Platonic understanding of archetypes, some of the shifts that Aristotle brings into it, which are bringing a more dynamic, teleological, and immanent understanding. And then Plotinus's further elaborations on the term, and then the recovery of the term within contemporary depth psychology, which first starts inside the human psyche, but then through developments within depth psychology, particularly we see with Jung and Groff and Hillman too, it breaks beyond the human boundary, the human psychological boundary, to where we come to see archetypes as informing matter and psyche, inner and outer worlds. And in that sense, there begins to be a kind of rapprochement between the depth psychological understanding of archetypes and the Platonic tradition's concept of archetypes with the great movements of the planets in the cosmos, serving as this extremely powerful structure of ongoing processive structure of evidence for the reality of archetypes and their patternings of human experience.
Sure, and you make a point in the book of saying that astrological archetypes are capable of manifesting as internal or external events. And while it seems like in archetypal astrology there's a tendency to focus on psychological states, it seemed like at one point in the book that you expressed the importance of not just limiting them to internal states, but acknowledging the potential for some sort of external manifestation in events.
Well, sure. For example, let's say, I gave a lecture last night on to a group in China by webinar on Frida Kahlo, the Mexican painter. And, you know, she had as many things that you can see in her chart that correlates so much with her art and her, but also her personality, but also her biography, including events that happened to her, not just events that she precipitated. So, for example, there's that, you know, she's got a Mars-Uranus conjunction opposite her sun. There's more to it than that. It's actually opposite sun, Jupiter, Neptune. But the Mars-Uranus conjunction is very tight, very potent, and exactly opposite her sun. And it certainly fits her bold, fiery, creative, rebellious personality and her capacity to really kind of impulsively break through all sorts of constraints, social and artistic and so forth. But that tendency of Mars Uranus for like explosive, impulsive actions can also come at one in ways that one has not precipitated at all. For example, the sudden catastrophic accident that she had riding on a streetcar in Mexico when she was quite young, and that shaped her life in so many fundamental ways. That and causing sharp pain, which is a Mars-Uranus kind of thing, and lacerations and so forth, many operations. All these Mars-Uranus phenomena were set in motion by a sudden explosion of energy, unexpected, which is Mars-Uranus, but it didn't come from her. It was in the environment. It was a physical event that she did not set in motion. She wasn't driving a car or anything. She was riding, minding her own business, but then it happens to her. And so the archetypes that are represented in the symbolized in the birth chart and in the ephemeris, as we look at our transits, are not only relevant to who we are in a sense of our conscious personality, or even just things that originate inside ourselves. It's the whole gestalt of our lives, inner and outer, the events that happen to us, the kinds of people that not only we draw towards us, because there you could think of it as being you're psychologically in charge, you're pulling people towards you. Well, there's that, but there's also people who come to you out of the blue that you weren't looking for, that you didn't unconsciously invite, but who just go out of their way to find you. And in all those ways, that shows how much the archetypes are, they transgress the boundary between inner and outer, and between the material world and the psycho-spiritual world. They're a unitary principle that transgresses the strict structures of the Cartesian subject-object dichotomy.
Right. And in connection with that, one of the points that you make, and one of the things that seems to be a general philosophical principle that the archetypal school has adopted, is the idea that astrology is not concretely predictive, but only archetypally predictive. And so therefore, the focus is not on predicting specific concrete outcomes, but instead sort of discerning archetypal dynamics that unfold over time, right?
That's correct. And that's because archetypes have a range of possible meanings that, just as in that example, the Mars-Uranus conjunction in Frida Kahlo's chart, that are expressed vividly in her paintings, in her visions, in her personality, in her actions, but also in things that happen to her and the kinds of people that are drawn towards her. The whole circle of revolutionaries that she tended to hang out with and have relationships with. So in all those ways, that multidimensionality and also multivalence, those are two different terms. The multidimensionality refers to the fact that it could happen in the inner world or the outer world, in actions or in images or dreams or whatever, while the multivalence has to do with the fact that Mars-Uranus could express itself in two or three or many different ways in the inner world. It could be a person who experiences a capacity for boldness and courage, but it also could be a person who is impulsive and rash. It could also be a person who is loves doing risk-taking things, or who it can be is very fast-moving, driving race cars or speeding down ski slopes on their skis and so forth. These are all ways in which it's all happening in the same dimension of the inner psychic impulses, but they're multivalent, going from very noble courage to very less than noble, in your face, immature, knee-jerk, compulsive rebelliousness, and turning everybody that you meet into a repressive homeroom grade school teacher that you didn't like, and therefore you're going to disobey.
Right.
Okay, so this is all these different ways are true to the Mars-Uranus complex or the Mars-Uranus archetypal combination, but which way that comes out is not necessarily visible just by looking at the birth chart. We have to, and that's what we mean, that the birth chart is archetypally predictive. We definitely get a sense for what archetypal principles are being activated and in what combinations and in what times. But as to whether it's going to be that courage in a noble activity, or is going to be a kind of immature juvenile delinquency that is self-destructive and perhaps risking themselves and getting into physical injuries and so forth. That's, I think, a person with intuitive abilities, clairvoyant abilities, psychic capacities. They can combine the astrological data, the astrological information, with their their intuitive capacity and may be able to zero in on a concrete prediction. And that's where a divinatory potential comes into astrology, but it's definitely there. It's not there. Not everybody has it. Not everybody has equally well-developed intuitive or clairvoyant skills and abilities, but it's definitely potential. It's there. But astrology just by itself, I think, is in terms of looking at a birth chart, looking at the transits, not knowing anything else about the person from some internal intuitive reading of their inner life and of the future. I think that's why we would say astrology is best understood as archetypally predictive and not concretely predictive.
Then one of the philosophical conclusions that you draw from the multivalent nature of planetary archetypes is that this leaves room then for free will and makes, because they have so many different meanings and because you could have a manifestation of this sort of spectrum of, let's say, subjectively positive or subjectively negative manifestations of the same archetype, that there's something about it that's inherently indeterminate, and that archetypes in that sense are more participatory and co-creative, right?
That's exactly right. You're putting it very well. And it's the multivalence of the archetypes, their fundamental indeterminacy is, even though whatever comes through will be faithful to the core essence of that archetype, but because that essence does have this rich plenitude of, you know, iridescent variation of aspect is the way the Neoplatonic philosopher of our own time, J.N. Finley, put it when he was describing the archetypal ideas in the Platonic tradition. They have an iridescent variation of aspect or meaning. And that iridescence is crucial, I think, to giving us human beings, as we look at our transits and we look at our charts, a feeling of our authentic range of possibilities, and therefore a kind of self responsibility. We're not just going to be under the gun of a all determining fate that's coming from this transit happening. There's a number of ways it could come through, and I personally think, you know, some things may be karmically quite destined, and that is another level of determinism that is playing a role in life. But from the just within the astrological frame of reference, I think it's much more empowering and liberating and psychologically accurate to recognize that we have a range of ways in which we can use this energy. When Mars conjoins my moon as a transit, I can find myself getting hot under the collar about little things around the house that normally wouldn't bother me, or I could, foresee that kind of rash response to minor domestic and emotional issues, and I could use that energy to do some spring cleaning today, just discharge the Mars energy in some way that is authentic to the archetype, but not limited by any one particular meaning.
Right. Take a Taekwondo class or something like that.
Exactly. Yeah. Very good. Very good example.
All right. So I want to move on to the sort of post cosmos and psyche period over the past 10 years, since we've covered not all of the points of the book, obviously, since this is a very large book, but we've covered a lot of the main points that I wanted to cover. One of the things I want to make sure we touch on is just one of the outgrowths, it seems, of the book and of the group of students and other sort of people that you've been working with, especially in San Francisco over the past decade, has been this amazing journal called the Archai Journal, the Journal of Archetypal Cosmology, that first started being published in 2009. And that was published largely by students of yours or people that were people you're doing research along similar lines, right?
That's correct. Pretty much, I think, yeah. Everybody who were on the editorial staff and at that time had been had come through my philosophy, cosmology, and consciousness program. They'd gotten master's or PhDs, master's degrees. I think generally PhDs at our school, and then they began editing this journal as a simultaneously a scholarly journal, but one that was going to take the astrological frame of reference seriously and explore it in a rigorous way.
Yeah, I mean it's basically like if there was an actual scholarly journal for astrology, this is it basically, or this is, I've not seen anything, even some of the older journals like Correlation, are not quite up to the same standards or don't have the same focus in terms of what they're attempting to achieve. And certainly none of the contemporary research organizations for astrology produce anything of this caliber. So it's filling a really important and really interesting role in the community in terms of what it's doing. And it recently, so that a new issue just came out. I just got it this week. It's really great. So there it seemed like there's a little bit of a break for a few years, but now they're resuming publication and it's being helmed by your daughter at this point, right?
Well, actually two people, Becca Tarnas and also Grant Maxwell. And the first, it's an annual, and the first several issues starting in 2009, 2010, were edited particularly by Kieran LeGrice, Rod O'Neill, and Bill Street. And what happened is after several years, their work continued to evolve. And actually, Kieran, who had been playing the key role overseeing the journal editing in the latter part of that period, he was appointed a professor and then a chair of the Depth Psychology and Humanities Program at Pacifica Graduate Institute, a graduate school in Santa Barbara, California, that focuses particularly on Jungian and archetypal psychology and the humanities and mythology. And so, as anybody who is a professor knows, especially if you're a chair, you suddenly get your hands full with a lot of other things. And so what happened was a new generation of archetypal astrologers and scholars who have been initiated into this discipline took up the opportunity of this journal that had established a very good track record and have taken on the mantle of it. And I think they've done a splendid job, Grant and Becca, in this this new incarnation that, as you say, just came out this summer. The new issue is focused on Saturn and has a great black cover with white type. And we were able, years ago, James Hillman, who I was pretty close to, and who was really a kind of one of the major inspirational figures in the emergence of archetypal astrology, just as he was kind of the founder of, and certainly the leading figure in archetypal psychology, going back to the 1970s. And the very first essay I read of his, was on Saturn. It's called On Senex Consciousness, Senex being the Latin word for old man, old person, as in senescence or senile or senator. And, I thought when I read that back in the 70s, this was the most brilliant exploration of an astrological archetype I'd ever read, even though he's clearly drawing on astrological traditions. He's not confined by it. He's not writing just as an astrologer. He's writing as a man of letters and deep culture and wide learning. And that essay, he died recently, but before he died, I was visiting at his home in Connecticut, and I asked him, could we republish that essay in Archive Journal? And he said, yeah, sure, that would be good. We both agreed it would be give a new generation a chance to encounter these ideas. And so it's the leading article in this issue, which is devoted to Saturn. And it's kind of appropriate that an elder, he died when he was 85, same age as Jung, that an elder would provide us with this kind of foundational work on Saturn. All these Saturn themes are very present, multivalently, one might say, in the issue.
Yeah, it's a really brilliant issue, and I love that essay. And it's appropriate in terms of, you know, it's been 40 years now, as you said at the beginning of this, since your sort of journey in astrology began in 1976. So people can check out the latest issue, or they can find the journal at archi.org, and I'll have a link up on the website for the description for this episode. And it actually has, on the Archive website, I really like, they've created a new website, and it has this pretty amazing glossary of fundamental terms and principles used by this group of astrologers for archetypal astrology. So I definitely recommend checking that out. Okay, there's just a few other questions as we wrap this up that I'll just give you to you in like rapid fire, and maybe we could just get through them really quickly.
Okay.
So let's see. One of them was, this is a miscellaneous question, but and it's a little complicated, but to what extent does the thesis of Prometheus the Awakener contradict the contemporary premise that is often used to derive new astrological meanings from the names of newly discovered celestial bodies? And in light of that, do you have any reservations about how this approach is being applied to new dwarf planets in the present time?
So the planets that were discovered and were visible to the ancients with their naked eye, they were named. And they were named at a time when the general state of consciousness of humanity at that point, and of those who were naming it, was clearly different than our consciousness today. There's many ways of describing it. Rudolf Steiner would describe it in one way, or the author of Julian James, the Princeton psychologist who had written about the bicameral mind, he described the shift in other ways. There's many ways of describing it, but there's clearly a great evolution of consciousness has happened over these 2,500 or more years. And what we as astrologers today are looking at with the planets out through Saturn is that we essentially have a legacy that we're receiving from another mode of consciousness that, best of my judgment, seems to have had a kind of direct access to the archetypal meanings of the planets, that Saturn, Jupiter, Venus, Mars, etc. They bear a pretty intelligible connection to the mythic figures in Roman and then in Greek myth, with Mesopotamian more or less equivalents behind those as well. And the planets that when they're named in the modern period, starting with Uranus in 1781, Neptune in 1846, and Pluto in 1930, these are named by people who are not particularly, they're not living in that same state of what I might call it, a kind of spiritually permeable consciousness that may have been in more intimate connection with the mythic realm, with the archetypal dimension of being, with the spiritual realities, however we want to talk about it, with the gods. And so as a result, their naming of planets may or may not be as relevant to the actual meanings of those planets or dwarf planets in astrological terms. And we need to, take our time in grasping and discerning those meanings through we pay attention to the name that was given. It wasn't entirely arbitrary. It's interesting. Uranus was named Uranus as a kind of logical sequence that if Jupiter is the father of Mars and Mercury and Venus, and then Saturn is the next planet out and it's the father of Jupiter, then we should name Uranus the planet after discovered beyond Saturn. That should be named Uranos, the god of the sky, who was the father of Saturn, Cronos. There's a kind of patrilineal logic into why it was named that, as well as the fact that this planet that was discovered is so far out in the sky beyond what anything, beyond any other planets, that how appropriate to call it the sky god, Uranos. But astrologically, so many of the essential meanings of Uranus have to do with rebellion and creativity and the impulse for freedom and unexpected lightning-like shifts of consciousness or insight or technology and so forth. And there's a trickster quality to it. None of these have anything to do with Uranus. And yet, the astrological Uranus does have something to do with the heavens, with the cosmos, with higher with astronomy and so forth. So you can see there is definitely a connection between the name that was given by modern astronomers, Uranus, to that planet, which empirically we can now see does have something to do with the heavens, with astronomy, with the stars, etc. And yet so many of the rest of the meanings of Uranus clearly have more to do with the Prometheus archetype and myth, the trickster, the great defiant rebel, the one who brought all the arts and sciences to humanity, that stole fire to liberate it, etc. There's just so many ways in which it fits. So I think we need to see these planets as they're being named today as potentially having a connection with the archetypal meaning that we'll discover astrologically through our close observation. But it isn't a necessary indication of the full meaning. Neptune, for example, again, seems to have a kind of synchronistically appropriate connection with water, the ocean, liquid, the fluid nature of things, the flow of consciousness, we would say, the stream of consciousness, or drowning madness, being saturated with images, etc. These are all Neptunian ways of speaking that are archetypally Neptunian, but also make sense in terms of the fact that Neptune, Poseidon, was the god of the sea. But then you look at the character of Neptune. In many ways, Neptune, Poseidon was like another kind of tempestuous, mean-spirited, patriarchal thug from the Greco-Roman pantheon, and very unlike the qualities of Neptune that we think of in terms of, let's say, universal compassion or mystical states of unity, high inspiration and so forth. So we need to recognize that there is often a connection between the new name and the actual archetypal meaning. This is even more evident with Pluto, Hades, Dionysus, certainly all connect deeply to the Pluto archetype that we observe. But I think to go deeply into the meanings of Neptune and Pluto, we have to range beyond Greco-Roman myth. Neptune clearly has so much to do with what the Indian pantheon can give us in terms of Shakti, Brahman, the dream of Vishnu, the quality of Maya, and Leela, the divine play, of reality, that the mystical idea of being a drop in the ocean of consciousness, that each of us is a separate but ultimately unified drop in the whole of the cosmic divine ocean of being. These are very relevant images and myths and deities from the Indian tradition that are very helpful for us to understand what Neptune is about. And same thing with Pluto, when we bring in Shiva, let's say, or Kali and her destructive and creative qualities, or Pele, the Hawaiian goddess of the volcano. So there's ways in which I think we need to keep a more, we shouldn't just jump on the bandwagon of this was named that, and therefore that's the only myth that we can grab our meaning from. That seems very simplistic and not adequate to the rich complexity of the relationship between the name and naming of a planet and its archetypal meaning.
Sure. Yeah, I guess I was just curious in terms of the tension between the modern sort of tendency to take the name as sort of synchronistically meaningful in some broader symbolic sense versus the sort of empirical side of astrology, the empirical tradition that sometimes can develop meanings after long periods of observation. And knowing that that's been sort of like a hobby horse for you, I was curious because you started writing, or you wrote early versions of that book that I mentioned earlier, Prometheus, the Awakener, back in the late 70s, as you said, or 1980s. But then we've actually had the discovery of, you know, minor planets and potentially another large planet here pretty soon. So it takes on a greater meaning, I think, now in terms of laying the foundations of some of these newly discovered bodies. Last two very brief questions. One of them that were submitted by listeners, one of them was, what role, if any, does the zodiac play in archetypal astrology? And I actually had a question about that as well, because it's not, you know, there's obviously a tendency to focus on planets and aspects. And I was curious if the zodiac is largely not used, or if it's just used in a much more reduced capacity in terms of your specific approach.
Yes. Maybe I'll just finish off one last sentence with the last question. Sure. You brought up, and that is simply to, I see both the empirical effort has to work with the synchronistic approach to the naming, so that you work with the two together in a kind of like a hermeneutic loop. Each one, perhaps each can help guide the other, but without being constrained by just one approach or the other, but rather we take both into account. In terms of the zodiac, the zodiac is very important, I think, to every archetypal astrologer who is, you know, we're quite aware of, you know, the fact that I'm looking at my chart, you know, I'm very aware of the fact that my sun is in Pisces, or my Mercury, Venus, and Jupiter are in Aquarius in the ninth house. And these are astrological factors and ways of making meaning that continue to be very relevant to me. I think two things happened where the focus came much more on the planetary archetypes and aspects, and the signs receded in significance. They color the energies, and they give us a quick way of being able to see what's in aspect and what the aspects are, but they don't, they're not as all determining as we see when we have, when we see that there's a Mars conjunct Pluto, natal aspect, let me put it this way. What made the big difference for us is when we were doing our astrological correlations with the Earth, with the psychological material back at Esalen in the 1970s, we found that it was far more important to it know that Pluto was conjoining the moon rather than whether Pluto was or the moon were in Scorpio or Sagittarius. The essential meaning was much more carried by the planetary aspect rather than by its sign or house position. If somebody had Pluto conjunct moon as a transit, we could be quite certain that was going to come through in the psychedelic session that they were going to do. While if the difference between them having the moon in Virgo or in Leo was actually relatively insignificant.
Sure.
It also, house positions were much more difficult to determine when we were working with figures from the past who were looking at, with whom we didn't have the exact birth time. And so, like, you're looking at Beethoven's chart or something like that, you're having to work with a noon chart. In that case, the house positions become quite not relevant at all. And then there, of course, there's the whole controversy of with the signs of the two zodiacs. And when I came to write Cosmos and Psyche, wanting to make this as intelligible to a non-astrological public, an intelligent public, but non-astrological, I wanted to be able to minimize the extra details. And so by just focusing on the planetary meanings and the aspects, I think it made it a simpler set of principles by which we are understanding the cycles of history.
Sure.
So those were the two big factors. But I see the zodiac as being, you know, quite significant, though I do see why Kepler, Johannes Kepler, did focus, as I do, much more on the planets, the aspects, including what some would consider to be minor aspects, as being very important. I see midpoints as being very important, and then the signs and houses shape, color, contextualize the those planetary meanings. But the planets are basically the big. They're the big dramatic center of action.
Sure, that makes sense. Okay, that clarifies things a lot, and I think makes a lot of sense in the context of the book and in terms of, you know, not having rejected it entirely, but just playing a reduced role or, you know, other things that were more important or more pressing, taking greater prominence in the book. So the final question from a listener was just a question slash suggestion about you maybe doing an audiobook version of the book of Cosmos and Psyche at some point, just because a lot of sort of more auditory listeners that listen to the podcast, for example, would love to have something like that. So I don't know if that's at all possible. Have you ever considered it?
I hadn't. I mean, people have been suggesting it for years for Passion of the Western Mind, and I it's something I should probably do in the long run. And I thank the listener for their suggestion, and I'll definitely keep it in mind. I've got a couple more books that I really want to get out first, as soon as I get through a number of my students' dissertations and a few other tasks and deadlines. But but I could definitely see doing that.
So you are planning on writing other books in the future, or you do have some in process?
Yes. I have a handbook on the planetary archetypes that's basically been written. I actually had it written 30 years ago, but I just need to take the time to do a comprehensive completion and refinement of that. Something like Ebertine's combination of stellar influence, but more comprehensive and a bit more balanced and more multi-level. That's one of the books. And then the other one is not so astrological. It's more a continuation of the end of Passion of the Western Mind and the beginning of Cosmos and Psyche, where I'm looking at our moment in history. So those are the other two books that are on the way.
Okay, brilliant. Well, we'll be looking forward to those. And where can people find out more information about your work if they want to find out more about either your teachings or writings or other things?
I think if they go to my website, cosmosandpsyche.com, just one word, cosmosandpsyche.com, they'll be able to get a lot there. They can also go to the CIIS.edu website, which is where I teach in San Francisco. That might, I think you can actually access that through my Cosmos and Psyche website. And then, the Archive Journal, which you mentioned the link for, that's also a good, way of learning more about, the kind of work that I've been, contributing to as much as I can.
Okay, great. And that's at archai.org.
That's correct. archai.org.
All right. Awesome. Well, thanks a lot for joining me today.
Thank you, Chris. You're a great interviewer and you did an extraordinary job of preparing for it, and your questions and the professionalism. It's just a very high quality. I'm very impressed. Of course, I've always been impressed by your work.
Thank you. Well, it's been a real honor interviewing you on this, 10th anniversary since I first read your book. So thanks a lot.
Thank you. I appreciate appreciate that very much. Well, take care, Chris.
All right. Well, thanks everyone for listening, and we'll see you next time.